This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. About 15 years ago, I was called to jury duty. My first reaction was probably like yours. Well, this is inconvenient, but that quickly passed. I had never served on a jury. If I was chosen, I thought I wouldn't just be fulfilling a civic duty, I'd be learning a lot about a process that I'd only covered as a journalist, as an outsider. I was chosen. It was a civil case that played out an awful lot like a case might on Judge Judy, an accident victim with a very aggressive personal injury lawyer, a defendant who seemed amazed she was in this position at all. We heard testimony and saw graphs and charts presented as evidence. They were tears and raised voices and the pointing of fingers. When the judge turned to us to deliberate, our verdict seemed, well, very clear to me and to almost every other juror. We had to convince one guy. We did. This wasn't a capital murder case or a long, drawn-out and complicated grand jury proceeding, but it was, in its mundane way, a window into a system we all rely on. It forced me into a room with strangers, none of us experts on the testimony we were hearing, all of us struck by how much this dispute over a car crash bubbled up so many questions about race and class and power and public safety and highway construction, how it challenged our preconceived notions of what a jury of our peers really means. I haven't been called again, but I can't wait. Today, juries, how they work, how they don't, and why this most important part of our democracy is treated sometimes as an inconvenience. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. Have you ever served on a jury? What was your experience like? We'd love to hear your story, and we will in just a moment. Coming up, an update on jury selection in the Boston Marathon bombing case, and we'll hear from someone who served on a federal grand jury. I want to welcome in from Washington, D.C., Andrew Ferguson, who's the author of Why Jury Duty Matters. He's an assistant professor of law at the University of the District of Columbia. Thank you so much, Andrew, for joining us.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Also joining us in studio is Tejas Bhatt. He's an assistant public defender for the New Haven Judicial District. He's joined us in the program before. Welcome back to the show, Tejas.
Thank you, John. I'm glad to be back.
I want to go to Andrew Ferguson first and just ask us why we have this system that we do. And why do we have six or 12 people who aren't experts on something decide the fate of so many? Why do we work it this way?
Well, it's part history and it's part symbolism. I mean, the right to a jury trial came over on those first boats to America. It's literally in the Jamestown documents that survive. We had rights to jury trials in all the colonies and the states. It's part of the Constitution. The right to a criminal jury trial is the only right to make a repeat appearance in both the actual text of the Constitution and then the Bill of Rights. And so it is part of our history, but it's also quite symbolic. It is one of the only institutions beholden to no one, where ordinary citizens come in together to make a hard decision, a collective decision about a difficult problem. And you know what? They do it pretty well over every day, every week of the year. These jurors are coming together to make really hard decisions in really difficult cases, and they do it well. So it works, and that's why we've kept it.
You say juries tend to get things right. What do you mean?
As a practical, factual matter, they tend to be as accurate, if not more accurate, than judges. And judges actually are some of the best fans of juries because they see juries work and jurors work every day, and they recognize that they tend to get it right. Most cases that make it to a jury trial are the difficult cases, right? The easy ones settle out. They either are pled out in the criminal context or they settle out in the civil context. So the hard ones get to a jury, and there may not be a right answer. There may be imperfect facts. There may be credibility determinations, and 12 citizens or 6 citizens, depending on your state, come together to make a really hard decision. And, 12 minds tend to be better than one.
So what aren't they good at? What are the parts of the jury system that you think either could be improved or that haven't been as successful as perhaps we'd want?
The jury is very much like America. So all of the weaknesses of America, right, our racial and gender bias that pervades much of culture, our civic ignorance at times, our sort of fascination with spectacle and emotion, which is much of, our television and other things, obviously impacts how ordinary citizens view things. At the same time, and so many of those weaknesses are real. But at the same time, many of the benefits of America, in terms of the fact that ordinary people do the hard work of democracy, ordinary people make decisions every day, ordinary heroes who are not, big politicians or big people are making these difficult calls, are also prevalent in juries. So you basically have the good and the bad of America and Americans inside in a microcosm of the jury.
And we're going to hear from some Americans who've served on juries in just a moment at 860-275-7266. I want to ask Tejas Bhatt, though, as a public defender, how do you view juries? What's good about them? What's maybe not so good about them?
I think I'd echo the comments that were just made. I think that as a criminal defense lawyer, we love juries and we hate juries at the same time. I think we love juries because of the reasons that were just stated. It is a microcosm of America. You do, in Connecticut, have 6, except in cases where the sentences of life, where there would be 12. And it's always easier, in a sense, to convince one person out of 6 that the state hasn't proven its case or there's something sort of off about the witness. It's easier to relate to people and say, how would you put yourself in this position, which you're not technically allowed to do. But essentially, these are cases that involve factual scenarios of people who are out on the street. They involve real life situations, and it's in a lot of ways it's easier to have jurors connect to that. Where I don't like them is that the way we treat jurors is really problematic. I think that we expect jurors to do a lot of things that they're not used to normally doing. We ask them to make really important decisions. And we do that by giving them all this legalese and all this sort of complicated legal analysis for them to do and ask them to sort of make judgments that a lot of them are not really comfortable making. And I think that's the problem.
Well, and I think even just something you just mentioned, think about the way most of us have conversations in the world. If you start telling me a story about your life, I'm immediately thinking about a story in my life that I can relate that to. I'm going to say, well, if your car broke down on the way here, I'm going to tell you a story about how my car broke down. The problem with the way juries are expected to act is they're supposed to look at the facts that are in front of them, not necessarily relate or be in the shoes of that other person. And that takes us, I think, just one of the most difficult things you can ask a human to do.
It absolutely is. And a lot of times you have people who come into juries who are not prepared. When I'm selecting a jury in a criminal case, one of the questions we ask them in jury selection is, when you heard the charges, what was your sort of initial reaction? And almost to a T, the response I get is, oh, I never thought I'd be on a criminal case. And now you have these lay people who have to think about, am I going to have to put aside 2 weeks of my life to sit here and to judge somebody else? And then we're told you're not allowed to think about this, you're not allowed to talk about this until the end of until the end of evidence. And then only strictly apply the judge's rules and the rules of law to the facts as you find them, whatever that means. I think it's a very difficult task, and I think we underestimate how complicated it is for juries, and I think we need to make it easier for them to follow along and to participate in the process.
Well, and Andrew, I'd like your thoughts on that before we get to some phone calls, because I think that's the big part. You end up with people who aren't really, not just experts in the law, they're not experts on whatever it is they're going to hear, but they're being asked to follow these complicated instructions. It's the first time they've been thrown into this. Their lives are being turned upside down. It's almost like we're asking people to do the most important thing we have to do in America, but yet we've prepared them so badly.
I completely agree. I think that one of the things that we don't do is we don't invest in the information that jurors should have before they become jurors in some sense, or at least when they get that summons in the mail before they become the actual sitting jurors. We know at some point that almost every citizen who's eligible will be serving on a jury. The issues that will come before a jury, issues of beyond a reasonable doubt, what is probable cause, what is negligence, are foreseeable issues that people can think about and discuss beforehand. And yet we as a society invest almost no money in it. If you compare what we invest in our political campaigns, right, if we get the Koch brothers to put $1 billion in investing in juries, it would change things. We would actually educate people about what juries do, why it's important, and some of these legal concepts that, I always say it almost borders on irresponsible. That the first time you think about what beyond a reasonable doubt is in the jury room with 12 people to decide someone's fate. You might want to think about that before you show up. You might want to do some work beforehand. But as a society, as a court system, as a bar, a legal bar, as lawyers, we don't do much to invest in juries and in jurors. And we really should have an educational campaign to show, A, why jury duty matters, but B, why jurors have a really important and really meaningful role in society. And it's a powerful role that they should claim as part of citizen power.
I'll let you make that ask of the Koch brothers and see what they say to that. Let's go to some phone calls here. Sean's in New Haven. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Sean.
How are you doing?
Good. What's on your mind?
I a few months ago, I was summoned for jury duty in New Haven, and what I experienced was odd. out of about 30 or 40 people who were there, I can say that there was only one black person and maybe two Asian folks. The rest were all white. And you know, New Haven County is about 66% white, 33% others. So this was an odd phenomenon for me to observe. And I was not selected. I was being considered for an alternate jury position. But for the case that I was considered, it was a very serious case. And the defendant was a black person. His lawyer was white. The judge was white. The prosecutor and his assistant were white. And all of those people who were being considered for the alternate jury position, they're all white or one Asian guy was there. So, I'm thinking, is this a common phenomenon in Connecticut? And if it is, why? And is there anything being done to address this anomaly?
You raise a really important question, Sean, which I want to put to Tejas Bhatt. I mean, this is one of the real key things here. A jury of our peers, and the question is, who are our peers?
Right, and that's exactly right. I think the experience that Sean had is very common, at least in the large cities in Connecticut. I'm assuming, I haven't practiced in somewhere like Willimantic, but I'm assuming that would almost certainly be the case there. Every time that I'm picking a jury, other attorneys in my office that I know are picking a jury, we sit and watch, and every day a panel of 20, 30 comes in, and almost inevitably the numbers are overwhelmingly in favor of people being white origin and not minorities, and almost always the defendants are minorities. There are a couple of reasons for that, and I don't know if the method that we use to call people into jury duty has changed. I know there was some discussion, but they're done from voter rolls, they're done from driver's license lists, and a lot of people, at least that's been the experience or the sort of common explanation, is that people of color who live in the cities don't register to vote, don't usually get licenses, don't like to give information to the government about their sort of whereabouts, and that reduces the percentage of people of that neighborhood and their community who will come in to serve on juries. It is a big problem, and I think many people have discussed how to increase participation from a jury of your peers, which is supposed to be sort of demographically the same as you are, or part of the community that you're a part of. But that's also been held to be not a requirement for the jury that ends up serving on your case, just the pool from which the jurors are selected.
So there's these two ends, Andrew. There's the end in which we clearly want to get more people involved in the process, to get more people into the jury pools so they look more like the cities or they look more like America. Then, of course, there's the other problem pushing on the other end, that we have a disproportionate number of minority folks in our criminal justice system, which is something we've talked about a lot on the program and which has its own series of issues around it. So to our caller, how do we reconcile these things? He looks at a jury and says, this doesn't look like my community at all.
I think he's right, and I think that it's something that the people who are in charge of jury selection and the people who are in charge of the courts need to worry about, because it's a symbolic problem. If it looks like this is not a fair cross-section, it's not only a constitutional problem, a Sixth Amendment problem, if the veneer doesn't represent the actual demographics of the society, but it's a legitimacy problem. People will not accept that these verdicts are legitimate verdicts if a jury of your peers is not present. And so what the Supreme Court has said when they look at jury veneers, a larger pool, is you need to have a symbolically fair cross-section. So when people look at this process, they say it looks like it is trying to bring all people together to resolve this community problem, this community case, whatever it is. And if you don't have that, it undermines the legitimacy. And so I think it is a warning sign. If this is happening, I hope courts are recognizing it, and I hope the people in charge of jury selection will modify their jury selection processes to try to get some of the other people who live in the community, they live in the community, but just aren't coming to jury service.
Let's go to one more phone call before a break. Meg is calling from Guilford. Hi there, Meg. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have something somewhat similar to the previous caller, and that actually addresses some of the comments of your guests. I served on a murder trial in New Haven, and that was my first experience on a jury, and it was very intense. And I think the biggest learning curve for all of us on the jury was really grappling with the idea of beyond a reasonable doubt. Just like your guest had said, it took us a long time to really understand that that's what was being asked of us. And it was so interesting to be on the jury and to realize that this is a very, specific process, and what we're being asked is not to decide if we think necessarily that the person on trial committed the crime, if we feel like maybe they did. The question is, was there enough evidence submitted by the prosecution to go beyond a reasonable doubt? And it was very painful because we came to the decision together over the course of several days that no, there was not enough evidence to get beyond a reasonable doubt, regardless of what any of us thought. And then having to, you know, stand up and say to the parents of the victim, not guilty, was a very difficult thing. I wish that there were another phrase that we could use. I wish we could have said not enough evidence to convict, because for me, you know, and not being at all involved in the legal system or the legal profession, as was the case for everyone else on our jury, it was an extremely emotional experience, and yet we were being asked to approach it, you know, understandably, in such an analytical way. I just wanted to say it was a real learning curve.
Well, and I'd like to just keep you on for a second. Tejas sure. Bhatt, our guest, who is an assistant public defender for the New Haven Judicial District, actually wants to jump in on this. But I just have to ask you quickly before I let you go, Meg. Do you have a better sense of what beyond a reasonable doubt means now? I mean, after going through this process, or frankly, were you still very fuzzy about it as you were putting through this ruling?
Well, I think I understand it better. I think I really appreciate that that is what our judicial system is based on, because, you know, I know the idea of that is to prevent, you know, unreasonable convictions. It's just I'm just confused because, you know, statistically speaking, I think, you know, we see, I'd rather err on that side than on the side of just convicting because we think somebody might have done it. I don't know if it always works, but but I know that as a jury, that was a very difficult thing because there were many people on the jury who really thought, you know what, I really bet this guy did it. Mm. And we had to go back and forth about that's not what we're being asked.
Tejas, I want you to jump in. And thank you, Meg, so much for your phone call, because this is actually really part of the conversation we want to get to. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's such a great comment from Meg, because I think it highlights the real difficulty that jurors have in making these decisions. And you know, what she says about it being so difficult for her to stand up in court and look at the victim's family and say not guilty and wishing this or there was a different way to express it. I mean, it sounds so clinical to get up there, you know, and I think a lot of commentators have tried really hard. One of the biggest problems, one of the biggest sources of discussion is this sort of what does reasonable doubt mean? Mm-hmm. And it is very difficult to pin down and to explain. And I bet Meg, as a juror in this case, probably would have gotten an instruction from the judge that would have purported to explain what it is. But in the end, it's really these sort of vague terms. In fact, some states out west, they don't actually allow judges to define reasonable doubt. And so jurors are left to sort of make their own determination of what that is. And I think that's impossible to do. You can see the experience that Meg had with having a discussion with 12 jurors, with having instructions from the judge, that she's really struggled with coming to the right decision. And I think ultimately it sounds like it was the right decision, where you separate what your gut instinct is from what the state has proven. And that's really important. But I do understand and sympathize completely. I think these terms are quite inadequate to explain what exactly we're asking jurors to do.
Andrew, quick thought on this before we take a break, just on this idea of beyond a reasonable doubt and what we might do to improve the system so that jurors and the rest of us just understand a little bit better about what that means.
I think first I just want to say how proud and inspired I am about people like Meg. I mean, what she said and the way she said it is exactly why we trust juries. She said it, and you could hear in her voice of how much she struggled, how much she thought about the law, how she worked collectively with a group to do this. I mean, that's exactly why. She's the reason we have juries. You just heard it live on air. And as the issue, the reason why beyond reasonable doubt is not described is so that people like Meg and her people in our community can struggle with these issues and determine whether or not there is it. It's purposely not defined. They could define it. The court has chosen not to define it. State courts have chosen not to define it because we want to have the collective judgment of the jury come to that rule. There's no mathematical possibility to define it. You could say it's 98% or 91%. But the courts have said we don't want that. We want to trust jurors. We want to trust jurors like Meg to make these hard calls and to make those decisions.
We're talking with Andrew Guthrie Ferguson. He's the author of Why Jury Duty Matters. He's an assistant professor of law at the University of the District of Columbia. He joins us today from Washington, D.C. Tejas Botten is an assistant public defender for the New Haven Judicial District. When we come back, we're going to move into grand juries. Of course, we heard so much about the grand jury system in Ferguson, Missouri and Staten Island last year. We're going to be talking about that and taking more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about the jury system. We've been focusing on juries that decide civil cases or criminal cases, but we haven't yet got to grand juries. Last year, grand jury rulings in the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner on Staten Island led to protests and violence and a lot of questions about this system. So how does the grand jury system work? Does it work at all? Why doesn't Connecticut have the system in place here? Call us at 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We're going to get to more of your phone calls in just a moment. And we're also going to be hearing from someone who served on the federal grand jury. But first, Andrew Ferguson, tell us how the grand jury system is supposed to work in the places where it does.
Sure. Both trials and both jury trials and grand juries were built as constitutional checks on government power. Grand juries are determined on a state-by-state basis. They range in the number of jurors from 23 people to down to 12. Federal grand juries have 23 people. They're asked to determine whether there's enough evidence to move the case forward in felony cases. Usually the standard is just probable cause. And if there is probable cause, an indictment will issue and then the case will go forward. They are not mini trials generally. They are simply to provide enough information to allow the case to go forward. In some way like a jury where there would be ordinary citizens who will make a determination whether the governmental power to bring a criminal case should go forward. And that is what happens in most states. About half the states have criminal trials, criminal grand juries for felony cases.
So in Connecticut, Tejas, there aren't grand juries. Of course, you can serve on a federal grand jury in Connecticut, but there aren't state grand juries. Well, why don't we have the grand jury system here?
Well, we used to. And we used to have it until, I think, 1982, when there was a constitutional amendment to abolish the grand jury. And we replaced it with the information system where a prosecutor has the power to bring charges. I think it was abolished because of the various criticisms that exist about the grand jury system, the fact that it had become sort of a rubber stamp, essentially, for prosecutors who wanted to prosecute people. There was the secrecy issue, the fact that defendants were not allowed to have lawyers present during this sort of process where citizens would decide whether to indict that individual. I think there were a lot of concerns about the secret operation, the ex parte nature of it, that led Connecticut to abolish the grand jury for regular criminal trials. I mean, I think the grand jury system exists in some very limited form in Connecticut. I think it exists for corruption. I think we've seen that in the last couple of years. But apart from that, it has been abolished. And now we have essentially prosecutorial discretion in deciding whether to bring charges against somebody and a judge having to make a finding of probable cause.
I want to bring in someone who served on the federal grand jury in New Haven for 2 years. Bonnie Craig joins us by phone. And Bonnie, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi.
I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about your experience about serving on this grand jury that went for such a very long time.
Well, it did go for a long time. Actually, I really enjoyed the experience. I did not think that I was going to like it at first. I went unwillingly, but I went and listened to a video about how the process would go and started to become very, very interested in it. There were about 50 people called altogether. 23 were picked. I was number 25, so I figured it was kind of a given that I would be leaving. However, I ended up being that 23rd juror. The process started with a lot of explanation, both from the judge and then from the U.S. state's federal attorney. And each case was presented very, very well for us. I really tied into it very, very quickly just because it was fascinating. It was almost like a civics lesson. Each item was explained well. We had evidence. We were allowed to take notes. Those notes obviously never left the room. The whole process was explained. This business of secrecy was explained, and we understood it. And the fact was that things may never come to a trial. It may never leave that room, but if after that date, it didn't matter. We could not talk about it. The secrecy goes on forever for anything that happened because it may never have made it to a trial.
So first thing I think a lot of our listeners might be asking about is, if you served on this grand jury for 2 years, how often did you meet? I mean, it sounds like that's a great imposition on your life. How much did you actually have to put into this time-wise?
Well, 3 days a month for 2 years. It was supposed to be 18 months. It didn't always turn out to be 3 days a month, but often it did. Sometimes it would only be 1 day a month, and you would have to be there for the full day. And then the next month come around, and they would give you a call and tell you how many days or if there was going to be service on that month, and there always was at least 1 day. But I didn't find it an imposition. A lot of the jurors did. They did, but they didn't mind the process. But it was inconvenient for a lot of people. I was working part-time, so it was actually fine for me, and I understood it.
It's interesting, Andrew Ferguson. You know, one of the things we were talking about earlier about, say, a civil or a criminal trial is people are picked and they're thrown right in without maybe a whole lot of instruction. They don't understand what it is they're supposed to be doing maybe as well as we would like them to. What Bonnie seems to be describing in this grand jury proceeding is that she was there for a very long time. They explained it in great detail. It sounds in some ways like they prepared this grand jury to do the job in a different way than maybe a lot of trials are.
I think that's fair, and I think that probably is correct, in part because they had the time and the luxury of time to be able to do it. I mean, again, if you're talking about a two-year process, there's plenty of time to reflect and think about and educate, and it sounds like they did a good job. I mean, I think part of what, you know, is so revealing about her comments is that the jury and the grand jury were meant to be civics lessons. You know, Alexis de Tocqueville pointed out that the jury is this wonderful tool of public education. It's a free public school, he said, where you learn the skills of democracy, right? If you believe that we, the people, are supposed to run our government, well, juries and grand juries are exactly the place you're learning these tools. You're trying to figure out how the system works. And not only are you just learning it, you're doing it. You are actively participating in your government. You are acting just like the legislator, just like the executive. You're part and parcel of the process of democracy. And so it's supposed to be a civics lesson. And it sounds like she had a wonderful experience learning this very valuable civic lesson.
If you have questions about the grand jury system, 860-275-7266. Paul's in New Milford. Hi, Paul. What's on your mind?
Hi. I am a former civil trial lawyer and currently a pastor in New Milford. And one of the things that we grappled with in a Sunday school class that we had to do with just the questions around how grand juries are selected, how come it is more difficult in an excessive use of force case to bring a probable cause finding forward, things of that nature, some of the general mechanics, and I was at a loss to really answer those questions based upon my civil trial background.
Well, let me put you on hold. Let me ask Tejas Bhatt about this. And these are the questions that we've all been grappling with since Ferguson, Missouri, and since Staten Island. And I think many of us read the Nate Silver article that says, according to Bureau of Justice Statistics, U.S. attorneys prosecuted 162,000 federal cases in 2010, the most recent year for which we have data. Grand juries declined to return an indictment in 11 of them. Essentially, when we use that old phrase, you know, indicting a ham sandwich, you can really put down an indictment through a grand jury for almost anything. And then when we don't see indictments in these cases, including in Staten Island, where there's video evidence that we're all looking at, it leads people to wonder how this system works, just as our caller Paul did. Like,
How can we explain that this is what the grand jury has done when it seems so obvious that it's a rubber stamp in many of the cases?
And that's exactly right. I mean, I think it is really hard to explain how you can have a system of grand juries where the numbers are what you just said they are. I think it's 0.0%, only 11 non-indictments. And then if you look at the statistics for indictments in cases involving police officers, they are exactly the opposite. They grand juries did not indict police officers in, I think, a staggering 97 or 98% of cases that were presented. What is the explanation for that? I am frankly at a loss to understand how either Ferguson or the New York grand jury, in the case of Eric Garner, at least failed to indict. And going back to the conversation that we had with what Andrew said, I mean, remember, a grand jury is not determining if an individual is guilty or not guilty of a particular crime. All they're determining is there enough evidence to proceed against an individual for having committed some crime? I mean, by way of example, in Connecticut, for example, in cases that involve a life sentence, like a murder case, you have a right to a probable cause hearing. And the standard, again, is the same, probable cause. And we tell all our clients, you're never going to win this hearing. It is almost the lowest standard that you can find, slightly above reasonable suspicion. And you're almost always, judges are going to find that there's probable cause. It's the same thing. It's mind-boggling that these two grand juries did not return indictments. And I think a lot of it has to do with the way the cases were presented to those grand juries. And I think it then should rightfully turn the microscope on the prosecutors who were presenting this to the grand juries and sort of examine what exactly were their intentions. Because
I just want to put this to Andrew Ferguson before we move on to this conversation. I mean, so many of us, when we saw the prosecutor in the Ferguson case stand up and make the announcement that there was not going to be an indictment in this case, he then began presenting a bunch of the evidence that the grand jurors heard. And as he presented that evidence, Andrew, it sounded to many of us like exactly the sort of information that would have been great to have heard in a trial, in a jury trial of peers. And that's what was, I think, confounding for so many people about it, was not that the ruling was right or wrong. It's that we essentially seem to have some sort of, as you alluded to earlier, the very rare secret trial in which it was determined by this group of individuals behind the scenes what the fate of this person was going to be.
I think that's absolutely accurate. I think that really the prosecutor in this case made the determination which way he wanted the outcome to be, and then he presented a case to show that. I mean, it's very, very, very rare to have a target of a grand jury, a criminal indictment grand jury, testify, and then testify without real cross-examination like Darren Wilson did. You got one side of the story. You didn't get the other side. And if you read his testimony, which I did, you know, as a former criminal defense lawyer, there's a lot of things you would want to cross him on that was not asked of him to point, you know, poke holes in it. And to me, that was the outcome that the prosecutor wanted for whatever political or reasons that may be there. And so in some ways, it wasn't surprising. Once you read through the transcripts, you see that this was sort of the outcome that was going to be created. But the standard of probable cause is still pretty low, and probably the evidence that was there was enough to bring the case forward, at least to get to a public trial.
Bonnie Craig, I've got one more question for you. Having served for 2 years and having had, as you said, a pretty good experience, a civic lesson of sorts, as you watch the news of this last year and all of the criticism of the grand jury system, I mean, did you have any thoughts about it, about your role in the jury that you sat on, and just how we think about this part of the American democratic system?
I did have thoughts, and my thoughts were exactly the same as were reflected a minute ago. I felt as though probably the case brought by the prosecutor was very weak, because I don't think that it should have been that cut and dried. I don't understand how that happened. I was flummoxed by a lot of the process, because I kept shaking my head every time I would hear that again and again. But I tend to think it's because that is not what the grand jury heard. What they heard was a very, very limited amount of the evidence presented, and I tend to think that sometimes they can be swayed not by the fact that they're going to do what the assistant attorney had said they have to do, but by what the evidence was that was presented. Because there were many times when we sent something back and we said, we need to hear more. But I was just really, really amazed. And I thought, I don't think it was the fault of the grand jury. I think it was the case that was presented.
Mm. Bonnie Craig served on the federal grand jury in New Haven for 2 years. She lent us some of her expertise today. Bonnie, thank you so much for joining us.
You're
welcome. Really appreciate it. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Andrew Ferguson and Tejas Bhatt, and we're going to move our conversation to Boston, where they're still looking for jurors in the Boston Marathon bombing trial. David Boeri, who covers this case for WBUR, will join us. We'll take more of your calls at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, West Hartford teacher and author Cindy Rodriguez will join us to talk about her debut novel called When Reason Breaks. We'll use her story as a starting point toward an expanded conversation about the challenges facing teens today and how adults and schools are trying to help many students navigate these tumultuous years. Hope you can join us for that conversation. Today we're talking about the American jury system, a system which is being tested right now up in Boston. Jury selection is ongoing in the federal death penalty case against alleged Boston Marathon bomber Jahar Tsarnaev. Joining us in studio is Tejas Bhatt. He's an assistant public defender for the New Haven Judicial District, and Andrew Ferguson, who's a law professor at the University of the District of Columbia. He's written a book, Why Jury Duty Matters. He joins us from Washington today. Joining us by phone is David Boeri. He's a senior reporter for WBUR, and he's been covering the Tsarnaev trial in Boston. David, thank you so much for taking some time to join us today.
You're welcome.
So first of all, catch us up on this process. I mean, we were supposed to have opening statements in this case starting Monday, but we're nowhere near that. Maybe you can give us an update on this trial.
Sure. Today we're waiting for stragglers to come in after the blizzard. They're still having trouble coming into Boston. But let's go back to Monday. That's an important date because the judge had set that for opening arguments for a jury that, in fact, has not yet formed. And it goes right to the heart of the matter, which was this judge apparently was overconfident in his ability to pick a fair and impartial jury quickly. So they're slogging through voir dire now, which is, of course, the individual questioning of the jury pool. There are 1,371 people in that jury pool. Massachusetts is different than almost every other state in the country in that judges ask the questions here by protocol. The lawyers largely watch, although the judge here, Judge George O'Toole, is allowing them to ask limited follow-up questions. This goes right to guild interest, you'd say, because there's criminal defense attorneys certainly question who would be better at asking questions of a juror, because this one of the central questions, of course, is can you put aside all your preconceptions, what you've read, what you believe, the fact that so many of them say he's guilty, and follow the facts and the law. Now, when a judge asks those questions, you got to remember they're being asked by somebody that dresses in black every morning, sits high above everybody else, and is used to people standing whenever he enters or leaves the room. Lawyers would say he is not the best person to ask those questions because there's a power status difference.
Mm. So that's a very important piece of this. But let's get to this question of people's preconceptions. Essentially, what you're looking for here, David, is a jury that knows enough about what's going on that they might be chosen. I read a Boston Globe article, actually, about, you know, trying to chase out people who are maybe too eager to get on a jury like this. And then you don't want people who don't know anything about what's going on in the world, aren't part of a civic conversation, but you don't want people who have a preconception about whether it's Jahar Tsarnaev or about terrorism. I mean, how do you actually find people in the Boston area who are appropriate to serve on this jury?
That's the question the defense is asking, and they're saying you can't. You can absolutely not find people to give him a fair trial. They point to, and last week they've asked three times now for the judge to move this trial elsewhere. And in the last attempt, they provided emerging facts, and that was they looked at the initial questionnaires filled out by that pool of 1,371 jurors. They indicated 68% of them presumed he was guilty before hearing any evidence, and 69% had some sort of personal connection. They knew somebody who was at the race, they knew somebody involved in the marathon or one of the victims, or they had an allegiance to the race itself, to police, to somebody that was involved. The defense says these numbers are overwhelming, and they indicate that the trial has to be moved. There's very little precedent, however, in the federal courts for changing venue. The defense would point to, and it seems a very pertinent case, the McVeigh case involving the bombing of the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City back in 1995. In that case, a federal judge ruled that the two defendants had been so demonized that they could not get a trial in the entire state of Oklahoma, and he moved it 700 miles away from Oklahoma to Denver. The defense says that's what we should be doing, change the venue. The judge is insistent that in a population of 5 million people in eastern Massachusetts, he's going to be able to find a fair and impartial jury, and that's what he's bent on doing. And he keeps on saying that what's key here is whether people can put aside their preconceptions, what they know about the case, and follow the facts and the law.
But it's so, and we're talking with David Boeri, who's senior reporter for WBUR, and he's covering the Tsarnaev trial in Boston. I want to ask Andrew Ferguson about this, about the chances of getting what we'll call a fair trial. He mentioned just a moment ago, David did, you know, moving the case against Timothy McVeigh 700 miles away. Look, back in the day, long ago, it seems as though we might have moved a trial out of a particular location and people might not know the pertinent facts. But indeed, we live on a world in which I've got five televisions turned to CNN right now. I mean, it doesn't matter where we move it seems, Andrew. Everyone seems to have heard about this or is touched in some way. Can you actually get the jury that will give a fair trial to a guy like Jahar Tsarnaev?
I think there are two questions. I think there's definitely the group of people who were personally touched by the incident, right? And so clearly those people would be removed and they wouldn't be part of this jury pool of people who know people know who were injured. Knowing about the incident, knowing about the bombing is probably not disqualifying on its own if you can keep an open mind. I believe that's what the judge is trying to look for. People who weren't personally connected in any way, who may have, I think most of Boston was shut down and under lockdown as they were searching for him. So people were probably affected. But there are probably, you know, of those, you know, whatever, 30%, 40% of people who are there, that's still a couple hundred people. And you only need 12 plus your alternates to make this determination. So I think that's what the judge is going for.
But Tejas, another piece of this is a capital case. And what that means is that you need to find jurors who meet all of those other qualifications we just talked about, but also might be willing to then return essentially a death penalty verdict against this man. And that disqualifies an awful lot of people, theoretically, who might not believe in the death penalty or might have questions about its application here.
Absolutely. And I think that that's a really important point here, because what in a death penalty case, and I think the fact that it's a capital case heightens the impact of the publicity and the preconceived notions that jurors have. But also what it does is, death penalty juries are required to be what they call death qualified, which means that everybody who serves on a capital jury must be open to the possibility and be okay with imposing a death sentence. So what that means is that in a state like Massachusetts, which has no death penalty, in a state like Massachusetts, in a city like Boston, which has a large number of Roman Catholic citizens, a lot of them, the tenets of the religion, say that you're supposed to be against a death penalty, are automatically disqualified from serving on that jury. And so the pool of people who can now serve is reduced even greater. And so you're reduced and limited to a small percentage of people who have no personal connection to this case, who have know very little about it, who have no preconceived notions of it, and also who are open to imposing the death penalty. And so essentially what you end up with is a jury of people who either really want to get on or are really in favor of the death penalty. And I don't think that's a...
Here's where the rubber meets the road. And what's shocking to me, sitting in the court and hearing the voir dire, is how many people got past the first round who do know people, who were nurses, who were at the finish line, who were victims. It's stunning how many get through. Now, here's where the rubber meets the road, because both sides are going to have peremptory challenges. And just in case someone doesn't understand, basically, the peremptory challenges are where the lawyers strike seated jurors and don't have to give a reason. In this case, both sides have 20 peremptory challenges. Now, if in the process of forming that pool, the judge lowers the bar, so to speak, allowing people who know a lot about the case and presumed guilt but say they can be fair and impartial. Then now the defense has to use its peremptory challenges and pretty soon runs out of those challenges, so they're stuck with a jury that they may not like because the standards aren't so high. And, you know, what we have is a classic battle between, on the one hand, the right, the established right of people, the citizens, to have a trial in the district where the crime was committed, and the government is asserting that today in its response to the defense motion to change the venue. But in addition to that, you have due process and the right of individuals to due process. And when we have a death penalty case and you're talking about the ultimate punishment and you're talking about a justice system that we brag about all around the world because of its fairness and its basis on a jury, then it seems to me that you have to go that extra step to make sure your jury is fair and impartial.
And I'll just say, we're just getting this tweet coming through from Fox 25 News in Boston, breaking news that opening statements delayed in the Aaron Hernandez murder trial. He, of course, the former New England Patriots football player who is originally from Bristol, Connecticut. There is an opening statement delay there because a new juror is needed in that case. So we'll be following that throughout the course of the day. I want to thank David Boeri, senior reporter for WBUR. David, this is fascinating stuff. We'll check back in with you as this trial moves along.
Feel welcome to.
Let's move on quickly to Henry in Columbia. Henry, thank you so much for holding on. You got a minute or so on where we live.
Yeah. Hi, John. A number of years ago, I was called to jury duty, and it turned out to be a murder case. And I was looking forward to this. Not that it's going to be fun, but you know, it's a civic duty. Anyway, I went through the interviews, and it got to a point where I was asked if I would scrupulously follow the judge's charge. I responded honestly. I said, I will do so, but ultimately, in the end, I will follow my conscience. It turned out that I was not picked because of my response. But what this relates to in my thinking is the concept of jury nullification. If you convince somebody is guilty, but there are such incredibly extenuating circumstances that I can't in good conscience convict the person. So anyway, I just thought that's an interesting thing to consider.
Henry, thank you very much. And it's a great thing to consider. With just about a minute left, I'd like you to pick up on that, Andrew Ferguson, because this is yet another story from a juror here, or a potential juror, that brings up something else we just haven't talked about yet.
Well, it probably takes longer than a minute to answer that. But, you know, the history of jury nullification is, you know, part and parcel of America. It's actually part of the reason we have the jury system is because the founders distrusted the prosecution and wanted to have jurors to have that ultimate power. However, as the jury has evolved over time, the judge was absolutely right to say that jurors must follow the law as given by the judge. And the juror was right to be honest. And very, you know, that's the way you should answer if that's going to be your feeling, to say that if you disagree with the judge's determination of the law, you'll act on your conscience. And maybe the, you know, right result was that that juror was struck for that particular case. Jurors have, the citizens have the power, if not the right, to nullify. And it's a contested power in the sense of we have lots of good examples where, you know, anti-abolitionist slave, you know, people were nullifying people who were helping people in the fugitive slave world. Positive stories and negative stories of, you know, much of the South where there were people of color who were essentially not who had crimes committed against them, and white folks who were committing those crimes weren't convicted because white juries nullified. So there's a mixed history, and it's a complicated history in America. And your caller brings up a really difficult question that deserves its own show.
Yeah, well, you know what? I'll tell you what, Andrew Ferguson, let's have you and Tejas Bhatt back because I think there's a lot more we need to talk about. Andrew Ferguson, author of Why Jury Duty Matters. He's an assistant professor of law at the University of the District of Columbia. Tejas Bhatt is an assistant public defender for the New Haven Judicial District. Thank you to both of you. Thanks to Jonathan McNichol, who produced today's program, along with Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. This is Where We Live.